Hello and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly podcast, where we discuss some topical leadership issues. This week, we're focusing on events up to the 7th of December 2018. My name's Nick Scott. I'm an economist and academic working with the Institute of Leadership and Management, and I'm joined today by Kate Cooper, the Institute's Head of Research, Policy and Standards. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Nick.
The latest CIPD report on rewards management found that organisations overwhelmingly continue to support the provision of staff benefits, with 96% of those surveyed intending to maintain or increase planned provision in the year to come. In turn, the top areas for increased spending will be professional development, which includes training, health and well-being, which covers sick pay and employee assistance, and financial benefits, such as pensions and staff loans. So, Kate, are all of these organisational-wide benefits wholly desirable?
Well, first analysis, you couldn't argue that professional development, health and well-being, and financial benefits are anything but desirable. But they're only useful if they're accessed, and I think there'll often be problems with ensuring that everybody in the organisation has the opportunity for training and development, not just whether or not they take it up. Similarly, with health and well-being, there are incentives, there are sponsored bike purchase schemes, there are subsidised gym memberships, but if they're not reaching everybody, then that's not a benefit for all.
The report warns that as three quarters of employers don't review and analyse the outcomes of this expenditure, the true benefits from this spending is uncertain. So why don't employers evaluate the return on this benefits investment?
I think sometimes we underestimate the actual cost of analysis, the gathering of the data, and the real insight that that offers. If you say to people, are benefits a good thing, yes or no? Very likely you'll get the response yes, but why they're saying yes requires further exploration, and that's where it becomes expensive.
Well, our second news item this week looks at a new report from the Resolution Foundation, revisiting the experiences of agency workers. Their analysis reveals that compared to those who are directly employed, agency staff suffer an average pay gap of £2.40 per hour. Agency workers are, on average, younger, less highly skilled, and are more densely concentrated both in lower-level occupations and lower-paid sectors. While these factors account for much of the pay difference, once appropriate allowances are made, agency workers still suffer a pay penalty of 22 pence an hour, which translates to £400 a year when compared to a non-agency colleague doing exactly the same job. Is this a pay differential that businesses need to be concerned about?
It's interesting how often procurement decisions, which one could say the choice to use agency workers rather than to take on your own employees, is made at one level and a persuasive analysis is put forward for doing so. And then when it actually gets down to the working lives of people, they're sitting next to somebody who's paid differently because different decisions have been made at different points in time. And of course we should take this seriously. If the person sitting next to you is being paid more for identical job, that cannot but provoke feelings of dissatisfaction. And if you're worrying about the pay differential, of course, there's less attention being put on the work you're supposed to be doing.
Well, the report goes further, highlighting the absence of knowledge and power that is widespread amongst agency workers. Being caught between two bosses, your immediate local line manager and the remote agency handler, can make resolving issues problematic. The research reports a lack of awareness of statutory rights, including both sick pay and holiday entitlements. So where does the responsibility lie for safeguarding against any unwelcome outcomes?
The employer is choosing an agency based on certain criteria that it adopts. So the ethical management and care of those workers that the agency essentially is their employer must be foremost in when you decide who you go, which agency you're going to use. And agencies, if they want to get a reputation for attracting the best workers, but also being an ethical agency to deal with, can use this to enhance their own brand image. So it's not a case of it being wholly the agency's responsibility or wholly the employer's. It's in both their interests. But I think ultimately, if we go back to the scenario of two people sitting side by side doing the same job, the employer has a great duty of care here.
Our third item this week questions whether the default MBA mindset is increasingly at odds with the modern stakeholder model by continuing to place the traditional pursuit of profit above moral and ethical principles. In a provocative Vanity Fair article, author Duff McDonald reiterated his critique of business schools, citing, for example, the limitations of leadership behaviour at Facebook and Enron, where elite Harvard Business School alumni failed to address adequately ethical issues. Does McDonald have a point here?
He certainly does. And if you look at the way so many business school MBAs are taught using the case study method, the temptation to rush to the appendices and start analysing data because that can give you hard answers. And I think just as we've seen in the previous example, what might seem to be the right economic decision then gives managers a real problem of differently paid staff. And those sorts of details are so difficult to put into a case study because you're capturing something at a moment in time. But it's the teaching method that forces that to happen. And it's the really perennial problem of how effective can off-the-job management development be when it's taken out of the context in which it's happening or intended to happen.
McDonald's critique goes further when referring to Facebook CEO Sheryl Sandberg, stating that while there is no question that Sandberg is one of the premier managers of her time, given the scandals surrounding Facebook around data abuse and election interference, the pertinent question is whether she was ever really a leader. Do you think this is a fair distinction to make?
No, this is where I think I'd be interested to know where Duff McDonald gets his list of good managers do this, tick, 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 and good leaders do this. The definition changes over time. It changes from organisation to organisation. So to think that you can come up with a concrete definition. And of course, people like Sheryl Sandberg do both. They manage and they lead and they switch from one to the other. This is a very harsh criticism.
And finally this week, a recurring theme at this time of year refers to appropriate standards of behaviour at the office Christmas party. Online portal The Recruitment Lab has a light-hearted fictional piece about the perils of misbehaviour and the subsequent appropriate organisational response. So Kate, what's the Institute's advice on this topical issue?
We undertook some research last year on this very subject about the Christmas party, and we gathered lots of views and opinions from our members. And while the majority seems still to be in favour of holding one, there was a view, and it's the position we took, that essentially you're at work. You might be in a social setting, you might be where there's a lot of alcohol, you might be where people are relaxing, but nevertheless, it's work relationships that you are maintaining. And I think that's the key there. You want to maintain these work relationships. Hopefully you go back in the new year or after the party with those relationships being improved, but you certainly don't want to see them deteriorated.
Sadly, that's all we've got time for this week. Please go to the website www.instituteLM.com to find out more about the Institute of Leadership and Management. And please subscribe to this podcast series.